Thank you. That was a great talk, and very needed, because we actually see a lot of people who get PPD tests. Our next speaker is Peter Forstall, who originally is from Utah, originally from Washington State. He completed his undergraduate degree and medical school at the University of Washington. He went on to internal medicine residency training at the University of Utah, and then he went to Houston, where he attended the Texas Heart Institute for his cardiology and then also cardiac electrophysiology training. He moved back to Utah about 5 years ago and has been practicing in the Ogden area ever since. His areas of interest include cardiac electrophysiology, pacemakers, defibrillators, and ablations. And he'll be speaking to us today on what's new in arrhythmias.
Okay, well, thank you. So I'm going to be talking about what's new in cardiac electrophysiology, which is my specialty. And how do I get this to go forward? Here we go. So I have no disclosures. So we're going to talk about a smaller implantable cardiac monitor that's been just put on the market recently, a subcutaneous ICD. And then earlier this year, the Heart Rhythm Society plus other associations put out some new atrial fibrillation guidelines that we will talking about who should be anticoagulated, how to assess risk assessment, talking about atrial fibrillation, ablation, and then mini-maze and percutaneous ablations. So cardiac monitoring is very important in my specialty. Obviously, symptoms are not specific. So I often see people come in for palpitations, and they may feel the heart's racing, it's skipping beats, extra beats, and really documentation is key. I mean, there have been many people who I've thought they'll have an SVT, and in reality they have sinus tachycardia or atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. And we often start with a 24 or 48 hour Holter monitor, but obviously that can miss a lot of arrhythmias. Event monitors we typically put on for 1 to 4 weeks, and they're patient triggered events. And then there are the outpatient telemetry monitors that can monitor patients for 1 to 4 weeks. And that allows for continuous real-time monitoring through a central location. And that's either patient-triggered or automatically triggered continuously. Now, for several years, there have been implantable cardiac monitors, also called implantable loop recorders. Those are patient-triggered, or they can be automatically triggered. And it's basically the algorithm looks at whether the patient's rhythm is fast or slow or irregular. Now, this just shows what the current two devices that had been on the market for several years, about 6 centimeters by 2 centimeters by just under 0.5 centimeter. So it's smaller than a pacemaker, but it's definitely large enough that the patient will feel it. It has to be surgically implanted. It's an incision about 2.5 centimeters. I typically do these in the cath lab. They can be done in any type of outpatient center. And the battery is about 3 years. So the nice thing is that this allows for long-term monitoring of arrhythmias if the shorter-term monitors don't catch anything. Now, just released earlier is this new monitor, which is this called the Relivial Link. So it's only about 1 cc, whereas the previous ones were between 6 and 9 cc's. So it's much smaller, requires a much smaller incision, about less than 1 centimeter. Only a local anesthetic is needed. And it can detect arrhythmias at least as good, if not better, than the older models. So obviously, just from a patient acceptance standpoint, this is nicer. Because it's a smaller device, people feel it less than they would the older, larger devices. This is just me holding it, getting some impression of how big they are. They're actually quite small, as you can see. And so what are the indications for putting in this implantable monitor? Well, unexplained syncope is one. So really when there's a cardiac source is considered. So in people who've had unexplained syncope in clinical trials and they've had one of these implantable loop recorders placed, about 1/4 to 1/3 of patients we uncover a cause. And usually that's sinus arrest causing sinus pauses or AV block, transient AV block. And it's surprising because it may happen very infrequently. They may even have a normal EKG. There have been studies. There's one study that looked at actually goal-directed therapy. In other words, half the patients received the monitor, and then therapy was directed based upon what was found in that study. And it really does decrease the risk of recurrent syncope. Obviously, if someone has AV blocking, you find it, you put in a pacemaker, most of the time their syncope doesn't happen anymore. And really, this can be considered either instead of or after an event monitor. Let's say someone has infrequent syncope. If it's only happening every several months, it may not even be worth putting in or having them wear an event monitor for a month, because you probably won't catch anything. The patient won't. Patients typically aren't happy about having to wear a monitor for a full month. It's a hassle. So this can be used instead of putting it in just as a first-line therapy if the symptoms are infrequent, or if other monitoring and other workup hasn't been successful in documenting why. Also, cryptogenic stroke. So about 30% of ischemic strokes are cryptogenic. And there was a study that was done to look at patients who had other causes of stroke rule out, and they then had an implantable loop recorder. This was the older style loop recorder put in. And about 20 to 30% of patients are diagnosed with atrial fibrillation after 1 year. And what's interesting to note is that the atrial fibrillation is often found more than 30 days after implant. So let's say someone has a cryptogenic stroke. You think they're in the age range for developing atrial fibrillation. That may be an issue. You can have them wear a 30-day monitor, but even that may not catch atrial fibrillation. And obviously, this can change management, because if they do have atrial fibrillation and they've had a thromboembolic stroke, then you really have to consider using full-dose oral anticoagulation. Palpitations is another common indication for this. So people have symptomatic, infrequent palpitations, either not caught on shorter-term monitors, or where you think that it's infrequent enough that you don't want to have them wear a shorter-term monitor. And obviously, if people are just having infrequent palpitations and it's not very bothersome, then that's not really necessary to to document it. But if they do feel that it's a bothersome, or they're getting lightheaded or severe chest pain, and it hasn't been documented any other way, this is a great way to try to document it. And then in some people, for monitoring AFib burden, we don't typically put this in just for monitoring how much AFib someone has, but in certain circumstances we do. It turns out atrial fibrillation is often asymptomatic, or people have some symptomatic episodes and some asymptomatic episodes. So if you're not sure and you really need to know, then putting in the monitoring actually tell you what the burden of atrial fibrillation is. And occasionally, after we do an AFib ablation or a mini maze procedure, this will be placed just so we can really document how much AFib they have. That's more usually in the context of a clinical trial, though. Now, the next thing I want to talk about are defibrillators. This is just a cartoon showing how we currently place defibrillators. So this shows a two-lead defibrillator. You can see that the defibrillator is placed in... Is it possible to go back one slide? So the defibrillator is placed in the left prepectoral area, and this shows that there's actually two-lead defibrillator. So the leads are going into the axillary subclavian vein, down to the heart, one lead to the right ventricle, which is the shocking lead, the other lead to the right atrium. Obviously, you can have a single-chamber defibrillator, a dual-chamber defibrillator, or even a biventricular defibrillator, and this has really been the standard for many years. But there is now a new device, which is a subcutaneous defibrillator. And the subcutaneous defibrillator, the actual defibrillator generator is placed more in the axilla. And then there's only one lead, and it's actually tunneled subcutaneously. So it's underneath the skin, outside the chest wall, first tunneled anteriorly, and then up just median, just leftward of the sternum. And so the difference, obviously, is that this doesn't have any leads actually connecting to the heart. So this is all just in the subcutaneous space. So this was developed by Cameron Health, which was purchased by Boston Scientific. It requires about a 6-centimeter incision at the ICD site and a 2-centimeter incisions at the lower and the upper sternum. And so, as I mentioned, there are no intravascular leads. So it's much different than the standard defibrillators that we've been using. So what are the pros? Well, the most important thing is that it can defibrillate the heart out of ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, or VFib. And that's what's most important. Also nice is that there are no intravascular leads. So one of the concerns whenever we put in foreign devices is the risk of infection, endocarditis. And if this is infected, then if you take out the defibrillator, it typically doesn't lead to systemic infection or endocarditis. With a standard transvenous ICD, if it does have to be removed and it's been in for quite some time, years, then the leads actually can scar into the heart. They can, they're touching the tricuspid valve, the superior vena cava, and so extracting that does put people at risk of complications, including perforation or damage. And so one of the thoughts is that this will hopefully decrease that risk, or it'll hopefully decrease the risk of infection in the first place, and even if they do become infected, removal will be a less risky proposition. So what are the cons? Well, it can't act as a pacemaker. So it doesn't actually have a lead connecting to the heart, so it can't act as a pacemaker. There are a fair number of people who don't need the pacemaker part of a defibrillator. All defibrillators nowadays have pacemaker capabilities. In some people who have just a single chamber defibrillator, we may set the lower rate at 40 beats a minute, so it doesn't really act as a defibrillator. If you have a dual chamber defibrillator, we typically set it up to act like a pacemaker, where the lower rate's about 60 beats a minute. And the other downside is that this can't provide what's called anti-tachycardia pacing. So ventricular tachycardia usually is a circuit through around an area of scar. So if someone's had a previous myocardial infarction, there's a scar in the heart, and VT happens when there's a circuit within that scar or around the scar. So it turns out, let's say someone goes into a ventricular tachycardia at 200 beats per minute, the defibrillator can actually pace their heart about 210 beats a minute, or just slightly faster than the VT, and that can actually terminate the VT about 80% of the time. And patients like that because they don't have to get shocked. So this can actually effectively terminate VT most of the time. And by not having a lead that actually connects to the heart, this cannot actually do that. So what's the patient selection? Where would you not use this in? Well, you wouldn't use it in people who need the pacemaker capabilities or people who need a biventricular defibrillator. And you also wouldn't use it in people who have a known VT that could be terminated with this ATP. Now, what about people who you would use it in? Well, perhaps in younger patients who have inherited syndromes, like it's called long QT syndrome or Brugada syndrome, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, people where they don't go into VT, they go into V-fib, or it just can't be treated with this ATP. Or people who are high risk for sudden death but don't need pacing. So you can people with a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, they have a normal heart rate, don't need the pacemaker capability. It may be reasonable just to put this in. And then patients who are resuscitated for sudden death. So patients who, 30-year-old who's playing basketball collapses and has V-fib that's shocked by paramedics and resuscitated, that person really just needs this type of subcutaneous ICD. They don't need the pacemaker portion of it. The other issue is that patients who are younger, so defibrillators, the generator lasts typically between about 6 and 10 years now. They're much better than they used to be. But if a patient's 30 years old and has a defibrillator, they may have to have their defibrillator changed 5 or 6 or 7 times over the life. And so the hope is that the subcutaneous defibrillator in those people can reduce their risk of infection. Obviously, it's effective at defibrillating VT and VFib, which is the most important thing. Next, I want to talk about the guidelines for atrial fibrillation. So in March of this year, new guidelines were released by the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, and the Heart Rhythm Society. So I just want to go over some of the highlights. So it used to be that we would use what's called the CHADS-2 score to help assess the risk of stroke in patients who have atrial fibrillation. And so this would assign points to certain risk factors. Heart failure is 1 point, hypertension is 1 point, age of 75 or more is 1 point, diabetes is 1 point, and the previous stroke or TIA is 2 points. And the recommendation had been to fully anticoagulate patients who have a score of 2 or higher. Now that changed, they updated this and changed it to the CHADS-VASc score, which has been around, and they recommend using this now to try to determine whether a patient should be anticoagulated or not. So they used the CHADS score and just added a couple of more. So age, it used to be that age of over 75 was 1 point, now it's 2 points. It turns out 65 to 74 is 1 point, so those are new. Heart failure, hypertension are the same, diabetes is the same, stroke is the same. They added vascular disease, which is a history of a prior myocardial infarction, peripheral arterial disease, or aortic plaque. And then last is sex category, which is female gender, is 1 point also. And you can see on the right where it talks about the adjusted stroke rate per year. It really discriminates better between low and high-risk patients. So if you have a score, if a patient has a score of zero, then really their risk of stroke per year is quite low. And you can see that in general, with increasing number of points, you're increasing your stroke risk increases. Obviously, if you notice down here, it says that the risk is actually lower with 8 and 7, and I think that's actually just a has to do with the fact that there are very few patients in this study who had that many risk factors. So the CHADS-VASc score redistributes patients, particularly older women, to a high-risk category. And so if you have a 75-year-old woman, then that will automatically qualify them for a recommendation for oral anticoagulation. But it also better discriminates low-risk patients, where you may not feel that it's necessary to use oral anticoagulation. The next thing the guidelines recommended is selecting oral anticoagulation based irrespective of the pattern of AFib. So if someone has paroxysmal versus persistent versus permanent AFib, that really shouldn't change whether you decide to anticoagulate them or not. And the reason is that patients often don't feel every episode of AFib. So they may have, you know, they may feel that they can tell when they have an episode of AFib and come into your office and or come into my office and then need a cardioversion. But they may not want to be on anticoagulation. The problem is they may be having other AFib they don't feel about. You may be underestimating their risk of stroke because of that. So a paroxysmal AFib, just the definition is less than 7 days, it turns out. Permanent AFib is in people who have AFib where you're not trying to control the AFib, where you're just going to leave them AFib, not trying to get them back to sinus rhythm. And then persistent is just in between. It also turns out that for atrial flutter, oral anticoagulation is recommended according to the same risk profile as AFib. So there's not as much data looking at atrial flutter as far as the risk, but fibrillation, there's this disorganized electrical activity. Atrial flutter is typically 90% of the time a very well-organized circuit in the right atrium, which has implications for ablation. But the recommendation is that patients with flutter should be anticoagulated just like AFib. So there's we have to talk about when would you use the newer anticoagulants. And it has to do with the risk, but also what's called non-valvular AFib. And so non-valvular atrial fibrillation, the diagnosis or the definition in the new guidelines is in the absence of rheumatic mitral valve stenosis, mechanical or bioprosthetic heart valve, or mitral valve repair. Now, it turns out that this wasn't really well defined before, and they actually added this bioprosthetic heart valve or mitral valve repair, which is somewhat new, and it's not clear there's a whole lot of data for that. Because if someone has a bioprosthetic aortic valve, you typically don't think of them as having valvular atrial fibrillation. But this is the guidelines that they, or the definition they put in the guidelines. So in people who have a CHADS-VASc score of 2 or high in non-valvular AFib, typically the recommendation is to use oral anticoagulation. And the choices are warfarin, Coumadin, or one of the newer anticoagulants. So dabigatran, rivaroxaban, or apixaban, all of which have come onto the market in the last 5 years. And the guidelines didn't really talk about the differences between them or recommend one versus the other. They all were tested versus warfarin in their large studies and were at least as good, if not better than warfarin in different aspects. Each one had slightly different outcomes, but they're all positive. There haven't been any head-to-head trials between the three new oral anticoagulants, so you can try to look at the studies and figure out which one you think is better. A lot of it comes down to cost. So if patients want to be on a newer agent, then I just look to see what one is most cost-effective, which one is covered by their insurance. That's very important. Dabigatran has about 10% dyspepsia. Rivaroxaban is once per day, which is nice for some people. And apixaban did have a mortality benefit. So there's some subtle differences between them, but cost is a big issue. Obviously, warfarin is there and has been around for a long time, but the newer agents are much better because, in general, because they don't have the dietary restrictions and there are many fewer interactions with medications than warfarin, and they don't require the monitoring. So if someone has a CHADS-VASc score of 1 in non-valvular AFib, then really the recommendation is either oral anticoagulation, none, or they recommend even aspirin. I'm a little surprised they actually put in the aspirin. It turns out aspirin is not very effective at preventing cardioembolic strokes. There have been studies looking at this. Aspirin increases the risk of bleeding, intracranial and GI bleeding, and it's just not very good at preventing strokes from AFib. So I typically don't recommend that. Either sort of talk with the patient about the risk and decide with them whether they should be on full oral anticoagulation or not. If their score is zero, then really the recommendation is not using full anticoagulation and no aspirin. And if they have valvular AFib, really we recommend warfarin. One of the agents, dabigatran, they were doing a study to see if that works in mechanical heart valves, and that risk of thromboembolic stroke was actually higher, so that was stopped prematurely. So the newer agents definitely should not be used in those patients. Another issue that comes up is what happens in people who've had a coronary stent. So one of my partners puts in a stent, and typically we use aspirin and Plavix or aspirin and one of the newer agents for the stent, and then they have to be on an oral anticoagulant for the risk of AFib. And so we use this triple therapy. And the problem is triple therapy really increases the risk of stroke. So there was a study recently that looked at this, and this was put in the guidelines, that it turns out adding aspirin to the Plavix and the oral anticoagulant just increases the risk of bleeding and doesn't really change your risk of stent thrombosis. The concern is that if you're not on the aspirin Plavix, then your stent can thrombose early on, which can be catastrophic. So there are probably going to be very few people nowadays who have to be on triple therapy with all three of those instead of just maybe Plavix and an oral anticoagulant. So just about cardioversion. So let's say someone comes in to the ER and it's their first episode of AFib, and they know that they have been in AFib just for a few hours. That's when their palpitation started, and they get cardioverted. If their CHA2DS2-VASc score is 2 or higher, then really they need to be anticoagulated. So if they come in to see you in clinic afterwards, you really need to think about starting them on it, and really it should be started in the ER if possible, even if it's the first episode, because recurrence of AFib often is common. And as I mentioned before, patients often don't feel every episode of AFib. I didn't put this in the slides, but if people come in, let's say you see them in clinic, they have a new diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, and their CHA2DS2-VASc score is 0 or 1, you know, should you put them on oral anticoagulation? You may, and you may if you're considering referring them to a cardiologist or an electrophysiologist like me, because if they do need to have cardioversion and they've been in AFib for more than 48 hours, then you really can't just cardiovert them. You have to put them on full dose anticoagulation for 3 weeks before the cardioversion, and then keep them on anticoagulation for 4 weeks after the cardioversion, even if their CHA2DS2-VASc score is 0 or 1. So this was also placed in the guidelines, which is looking at assessing the bleeding risk of patients who are on anticoagulants. There's this HasBLED score, which includes hypertension, abnormal renal function, abnormal liver function, stroke, bleeding tendency, labile INR, age over 65, other drug use, and then drinking. And you can get some idea of what their risk in general of bleeding is, the bleeds per 100 patient years. Now, it turns out this was placed in the guidelines but not really strongly recommended because it's not very sensitive or specific. So I think it's good to know about just so you can get some idea of how to assess the risk of bleeding in patients who are on anticoagulation. But I wouldn't necessarily stop. I wouldn't stop anticoagulants just because they have a higher HasBLED score. Obviously, if it's very high and they're at high risk of falls and things like that, you can consider stopping it. But I think you really have to individualize this to the patient. So antiarrhythmics, there haven't been any new antiarrhythmics except dronedarone, which is Multac, which was put on the market a few years ago. And this, the company took amiodarone and actually changed it, took out the iodine moiety to try to decrease the risk of the side effects from amiodarone. Now, it turns out by changing it, it's not nearly as effective as amiodarone. It has its place in some low-risk patients, but it turns out over the last few years, it's been very clear that mortality is actually higher in patients who you use this on in people who have heart failure. So really, the recommendation is only to use this in people who don't have heart failure. Now, what about atrial fibrillation ablation? So over the years, AFib ablation really has been taking more of a role in our treatment of atrial fibrillation. And really, the guidelines say that AFib ablation is reasonable in patients who have recurrent symptomatic AFib despite the use of an antiarrhythmic or that are rhythm control strategy. Obviously, if people have AFib, they're asymptomatic, they really don't have any symptoms, they don't think that it's going to improve their life or their symptoms by keeping them in sinus rhythm, then you can just pursue a rate control strategy. That's very reasonable. But in people where you are going to try to get them back to normal rhythm and keep them in sinus rhythm, then ablation often is a good choice. It used to be that we would try at least one, if not two or more, antiarrhythmics before going to an ablation. There have been multiple randomized clinical trials that have compared antiarrhythmics to AFib ablation. And the success of antiarrhythmics to keep someone in sinus rhythm is really between about 20 and 40 or 20 and 50%, depending upon the study and the type of patient. And the AFib ablation in general is more successful, but more than one ablation might be necessary. And that's because people have recurrent fibrillation, recurrent flutters. Multiple procedures are more common in people who have more AFibs. The longer someone is in AFib, usually that means it's going to be harder to fix their AFib. Or if they have a larger atria, it's going to be harder to fix it. And if they have comorbidities. So sleep apnea is a big one. I ask everyone who I see about AFib whether they have sleep apnea. Probably half of people who have AFib have sleep apnea. And it turns out if you don't treat their sleep apnea, then even if you give them antiarrhythmics or do an ablation, they're probably going to have recurrence of AFib. So it's very important to screen for sleep apnea in patients who have AFib. Also about the recurrent, you know, the need for more than one ablation. I often talk to patients and try to make an analogy to people who have coronary disease. You know, it's very common for someone to come in and have to get a stent because they have a 90% right coronary artery stenosis, and a few years later they have progression of their disease, have to have another stent somewhere else, then later on progression and maybe an in-stent restenosis. And so it's very common for people who have progression of coronary disease, and it's really the same thing with AFib. AFib often is progressive. We do an ablation, and years later, all those triggers may actually come back, and that's why it's often more than one is necessary. So there's also a surgical treatment for atrial fibrillation called the mini-MACE procedure that's done by a cardiothoracic surgeon who has an interest in training in doing this mini-MACE procedure. Not all surgeons do. And so I've worked in collaboration with Dr. Dave Affleck, who has an interest in the mini-MACE procedure. And one thing that we've been doing and that some other centers around the country have been doing is trying to combine the mini-MACE procedure with the percutaneous ablation. And the reason is the mini-MACE procedure, so it's a thoracoscopic procedure. The surgeon can get to different parts of the heart that I can't get to with my percutaneous ablation. They can also ligate the left atrial appendage. And so he can get to parts that I can't get to. And what we've been doing for some patients, especially people who have persistent AFib, is doing the mini-MACE procedure, and then a few days later, actually me doing my ablation. And a lot of the ablation's already done. But the benefit is that I can check all the ablations that he did. I can do endocardial ablation that cannot be done epicardially, such as atrial flutter and other types of flutters, and mapping things out. And the hope is that by doing that, we can actually combine, you know, both procedures to improve the success rate during just one hospitalization. It really is for people who have persistent AFib. So people have paroxysmal AFib, usually just a regular ablation that I do is a very good option. But the longer someone has AFib, I talk to my patients about, is it worth doing multiple procedures over the next couple of years, or is it worth doing just one bigger procedure? Now, the downside is that the mini-MACE is a thoracoscopic procedure, so there's more pain and recovery, a little bit longer recovery time, and so that's the downside of that. So biventricular pacing devices, so biventricular ICDs we've been putting in for years now, and the indication for that are people who have a low ejection fraction of 35% or less, heart failure, a bunch block, and a QRS of greater than 120 milliseconds. And we do that because BIV pacing has been shown in those patients to improve heart failure symptoms and even occasionally improve ejection fraction and mortality, it turns out. But it turns out that in some patients who have just a regular pacemaker, if you pace their right ventricle a lot of the time, it actually can worsen their heart failure. So let's say someone has an EF of 45%, they need a pacemaker, and they're going to be pacing a lot. Over time, their symptoms can actually worsen, and their LVE can actually worsen. And this is just a picture showing the heart and where we put our pacing leads typically. So you have a right ventricular lead here, an atrial lead into the right atrial appendage for just a standard dual-chamber pacemaker. And then for the biventricular pacemaker, we put a light lead into the coronary sinus that threads out through this vein into one of the side branches of the coronary sinus. So we actually pace the left ventricle and the right ventricle simultaneously. So people who have a wide QRS or are paced in the right ventricle all the time, really they have dyssynchrony. So their heart is not being activated in the usual sequence. And by biventricularly pacing them, we can actually improve that synchronization again. And there was a study that came out last year called the BLOCK-HF study that included patients who had an EF of 50% or less, heart failure class 1 to 3, class 1 is really asymptomatic, so 2 is mildly symptomatic, 3 is moderately symptomatic, and who had AV block likely to require a high percentage of pacing. So there are some people who have just intermittent AV block and won't actually right ventricular atrial pace very much, but other people have a high likelihood of needing a lot of pacing. Those are the people who were included in the study, and they looked at death, heart failure treatment requiring emergent treatment or hospitalization, or a 15% change in LV volume. And there was a 9.8% absolute decrease in improvement in the outcome with a hazard ratio of 0.74. So very positive. And because of that, the FDA approved using biventricular pacemakers in these patients. And so it probably will increase the use of these devices somewhat. And really, it slows the progression of their disease. So it prevents heart failure recurrence. That's really what was seen in the study mostly. And actually, I'm going to stop right there. Questions?
Yes, Peter?
Yes.
In a situation where a patient has had an episode of atrial fibrillation during an acute stay hospitalization and they're started on anticoagulation, sometimes the question comes up months, even years later, with no documented additional atrial fib as to getting off the anticoagulation. What sort of monitoring or proof do you need to know that they can come off the anticoagulation?
And that's a great question because, to be honest, there's not a whole lot of good data. And AFib is very common postoperatively, you know, obviously, especially in patients undergoing cardiovascular surgery, but even patients who are having orthopedic or other surgeries, it's common. And if someone does have one episode that makes me concerned, I usually talk to them about the risks and the benefits. If someone has a CHA2DS2VAS score of 5, then that makes me a little bit more concerned than if they just have a score of 1 or 2. You know, if they have no other risk factors, I often would stop it, to be honest. If it's just if there's an obvious cause for it and that, you know, it was a surgery, I probably wouldn't keep them on long term. But it really, that's the time where you have to individualize and talk to the patient about the risks and see if they have any symptoms. So I typically wouldn't do any monitoring for them, but maybe a few months later, stop it.
I happen to have the Mini Maze by Dr. Affleck. So I'm wondering, that was 5-6 years ago, and what every once in a while I feel like I'm still getting a little atrial fib if I drink too much Coke. Mm-hmm. And so should I be getting one of those things those new ones that you're...
Well, so there are two issues. One is, are you really having AFib? And so, you know, as I mentioned before, documentation is key. So if it's infrequent and we really need to know, then it may be reasonable to have a monitor, whether it's an implantable one or not. It turns out with the Mini Maze, Dr. Affleck often clips the left atrial appendage, and so that does decrease the risk of stroke. Now, there are no randomized studies to know how low the risk of stroke is in people who have even persistent AFib and they've had their left atrial appendage clipped. So if there's short episodes with that, then I probably wouldn't. But if there's concern and you're symptomatic, then it's something to consider.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
So with the subcutaneous defibrillator,
yes,
what is the patient's experience when it goes off versus the regular ones? Is it more unpleasant, less unpleasant, or equal?
So it depends upon whether they're awake or not. So, you know, it's surprising. There are people who go into VT or VFib and they pass out. I've had people on stage performing, they pass out. And they get shocked and they keep on performing. They don't even know. You know, people come in, we check their defibrillator, it shows they've been shocked, and they have no idea. There are other patients who don't pass out all the way, and so they actually do feel a shock. It turns out the subcutaneous defibrillator delivers more energy because it doesn't have a wire connected to the heart, and so it actually shocks at a higher energy. But it turns out it actually waits longer. So it waits usually at least 30, if not 60 seconds before shocking. And the reason is a lot of times patients have VT or polymorphic VT, and it actually will terminate within about 30 seconds. So they want to wait until they know that it's not going to stop by itself. So if they're awake, then they'll probably get shocked. But it turns out with the subcutaneous ICD, they're more likely to not be awake when they get shocked.
One of the common problems which persists, but common, is the young person, usually a woman, just finishing childhood, who passes out.
Right.
Any advice on that?
Yeah, so the young one who passes out, you know, history is so important in patients who have syncope. And, you know, just, and a lot of those patients are going to be vasovagal syncope. And so if the history is good, then I typically talk to patients about the treatment of vasovagal syncope and salt intake and staying hydrated, avoiding diuretics, alcohol, caffeine, those types of things. So the monitors, there are patients where it's not clear, and I still will have them wear an event monitor. In younger people, we often don't put the monitor in unless, if they're passing out, it's really not clear and you're not catching it on another monitor, then it would be reasonable to put one of those little implantable monitors in. But if they're passing out frequently enough that they can just wear a monitor, then I typically start with that.
You were showing risks of stroke at the lower risk levels of 1 or 2%.
Right.
How does this compare with the risk of anticoagulation?
Right, so the newer agents, the risk, for example, of intracranial hemorrhages, that's one of the areas where it's actually very nice, and it's much better than warfarin. All three of them are. So the risks of intracranial hemorrhages less with the newer agents than warfarin, less than 1%. Overall, the risks of bleeding, if you add in GI bleeding, it can be a couple of percent. And so that's why if your risk of stroke is, you know, 1.3%, your risk of bleeding is about 1.5%, then it's somewhat of a wash. And so that's why the risk of 2 or higher has been used. Bleeding, if it's just in the GI tract, you can stop the anticoagulant and it usually gets better. If you bleed into your brain, then that's a bigger issue, right? Or if you have a thromboembolic stroke, then that can cause permanent damage. So you have to weigh the type of bleeding also.
A couple of years ago, a patient anticoagulated with Gavigatran died at the University Hospital of intracranial hemorrhage. If he'd been on warfarin, they could have stopped it. So the Gavigatran is not quite as innocuous as the...
Say that again, sorry. Someone was on warfarin and had an intracranial hemorrhage and died?
No, he was on Gavigatran.
Oh, Gavigatran.
Had an
right.
intracranial hemorrhage,
right.
and
right.
the university was unable to control it, and he died.
Right.
They thought they could have saved him if he'd been taking warfarin instead.
Yeah. And that's the concern, that with the three newer agents, there's no way to reverse them. Whereas with warfarin, you can give vitamin K or give factors. And that is a theoretical concern. There is some data that, where I think it was with dabigatran actually, where they looked at this and they compared just in a real-world situation, people who came into the ER and were on an anticoagulant, either dabigatran or warfarin, and they looked at the outcomes, people who had to, for example, have surgery, emergent surgery. And the risk of bleeding complication was higher in patients who are on warfarin than on dabigatran. And it's not really clear why that is, because you think, well, if they come in and their INR is high, you can easily reverse them, whereas with dabigatran, you can't. So at least in that small study, it didn't pan out that warfarin was higher. And they're both risks. So if you look at it, intracranial hemorrhage is definitely lower. Each of the three agents were statistically significantly better than warfarin at preventing intracranial hemorrhage. There's not really a way to protect that. The best way is just distance. And so with modern devices, the risk is relatively small. I mean, typically we recommend not putting a cell phone in a breast pocket over a defibrillator or a pacemaker. I personally haven't seen any problems with that. I mean, in the literature, there are these cases where that can be an issue, but just don't, you know, consistently have it within a few centimeters of it and you should be fine. Any other questions? Great.